Uhuru, you're listening to Diasporic Music on Black Power 96, and we have just almost completed the tribute to T.N. Providence. He did a tribute to Quincy Delight Jones, and the last track he was playing was by the late, great Dinah Washington, and Dinah Washington was a one of the queens. They had so many queens. Aretha Franklin was a queen. Bessie Smith was a queen. And I remember Dinah Washington was the queen of my father's generation. And Dinah Washington was a great artist, pianist, a lot of talent. And we're getting ready to talk to Dr. Gerald Horn. Dr. Gerald Horn is an African historian born in America who holds the John Jay and Rebecca Morris Chair of History and African American Studies at the University of Houston. He's the author of tons of books, and the most recent is Armed Struggle with a Big Question Mark, Panthers and Communists, Black Nationalists and Liberals in Southern California through the 60s and 70s. And I'm going to Melinda Francis is going to lead off with the first question.
Well, this is we're heading into the 47th presidency of Mr. Donald Trump. So why don't you give your take on Donald Trump's win?
Well, he won about 51% of the popular vote, which is unusual for a Republican to do so. But what I'm going to focus on primarily is the possible implications of Trump's foreign policy. But before I get to that, let me first of all critique some of the reactions to this victory, particularly from Senator Bernie Sanders of Vermont, who really should know better. What Bernie Sanders has said is that the Democrats lost because they paid too much attention to, quote, identity politics, unquote, and not enough to, quote, class questions, unquote. Now, he doesn't specify, like most people who use that term, what he means by identity politics. Does that mean Black Lives Matter? Does that mean, and oftentimes people, that's what they precisely mean. We're not supposed to complain about being shot down on the street by the police. And I guess if we can't organize a multiracial bloc, we should be quiet if we just protest about it. So I guess if Muslims who complain about Islamophobia, I guess that's identity politics. I think really what they mean is that they're embarrassed to say. What I mean by that is Republicans ran a ton of ads attacking the trans community. One of the most effective, in their estimation, was an ad that said that Vice President Harris is for they, them, Donald Trump is for you. And I think that when identity politics is bruited, they basically mean the trans community, but of course, they don't want to come out and say that because it makes them look like a bigot, which would be accurate. And then Thomas Frank, who wrote this book, What's the Matter with Kansas, that some people appreciated. I didn't, by the way, since I know Kansas. I probably know more about Kansas than he does. As a matter of fact, one of the things he said he was talking about Kansas because supposedly by talking about Kansas, he could evade the question of racism in terms of Kansas being conservative. But Kansas City, Kansas and Kansas City, Missouri, are right there on the border together. They have Black mayor, Black congressperson. The Brown versus Board of Education decision rendering U.S. apartheid unconstitutional was filed by Black litigants in Topeka, Kansas, the capital. And in any case, even in a state like Idaho that doesn't have a sizable Black population, they're infected by the anti-Black trends and currents that course throughout the nation, particularly on television and in the movies, and an interpretation of sporting events. And with regard to ignoring the class question, hasn't Bernie Sanders said, hasn't anybody told him about the Red Scare? Hasn't anybody told him that for like 75 years that the United States waged war against left-led unions and that many of the Trump base actually supported the Red Scare? And so that's another thing that, really galls me about this post-election discourse, is that this Trump base, which has in some ways been the author of its own misfortune, we're supposed to look at them with sympathy, even though they said that they don't like these unwinnable wars. But many of them supported the wars, like the war in Iraq in 2003, for example. Many of them say that they don't like the fact that jobs have left the United States. Well, many of them supported politicians when these jobs were leaving the United States. As I pointed out numerous times in the past, when the job exodus and the manufacturing plant exodus was at its zenith, the U.S. ambassador to China, the major recipient of these jobs, was Leonard Woodcock, a former leader of the United Auto Workers. And of course, that means he had influence on Canadian auto workers as well. And so these Trump-based folks, they inflict self-harm, and then we're supposed to be sympathetic to them, even though in many ways they're the authors of their own misfortune. That is to say that we're supposed to be sympathetic to them. And then the whole discourse doesn't make any sense. Supposedly, the Trump base, they vote for the right because the Democrats are not far enough to the left. Well, why don't these people vote for the Greens then, if they want a candidate for the left? Why don't they vote for Cornel West? I mean, what this ties into, of course, is this remarkable trait in the United States, which is what's called democracy, is basically anything that a majority of settler descendants decide is appropriate. In the 1850s, for example, there was a concept called squatter sovereignty. That is to say, if a number of settlers squatted on indigenous land and they were the majority, well, they could basically rule and do whatever they want. That was the consensus. And so you still have that sort of thinking taking place. Whatever a majority of settler descendants decide, and of course a majority of settler descendants decided to vote for Mr. Trump despite all of this controversy, so-called, about black males defecting to Mr. Trump. As it turned out, about 80%+ of the black community voted against the right, although this was one of the few constituencies that was focused on in terms of their supposed right-leaning. Nobody talked about if white women were going to vote for Mr. Trump, which of course they have done consistently. So part of the problem in the United States is that ideological backwardness and failure to understand the terrain on which you're struggling. And part of that is, a week ago, this past Sunday, folks were telling us fascism is on the ballot. Okay. Now, then after Trump won, they began to downplay it. Well, you know, he got less votes in 2024 than he got in 2020. If the Democrats had been more to the left, these people would not have voted for a fascist, which is like an illogical and a non sequitur. And so what they do, they rev us up into a frenzy before the election about fascism on the ballot. And then after the fascists win, they try to get us to go to sleep. I mean, oh boy, I don't know. I'm just, as you can tell, I'm thoroughly disgusted with not only the election, but with the reaction of some of our so-called friends on the left. Now, with regard to foreign policy, Canada is in trouble, because Mr. Trump is going to run a protection racket. That is to say that he's going to threaten Canada with tariffs on its goods, taxes on goods coming across the border from Canada. And The trade-off might be Canada spending more of your tax dollars on the military, that is to say, transferring it to the military-industrial complex. And here's another play that may happen under the table. The U.S. Supreme Court has said that a president like Trump, not any president, I mean, that's Gerald Horn saying that, because I think if a non-conservative president would try what I'm about to propose, they'd wind up in jail. But if a president exercising his so-called core functions, whatever that president does is presumptively legal and constitutional. A core function of the U.S. president is conducting foreign policy. So let us say that a message is sent to Ottawa that unless you give the Trump family $10 billion, they're going to raise tariffs on Canadian goods. Under the Supreme Court logic, that could be legal. And I could see Mr. Trump doing a shakedown, like the mob boss that he is, on countries around the planet, for example. Canada's in trouble also because it has bad relations with India, Russia, and China simultaneously, about to have bad relations with Washington as well. I'm not sure if a Tory coming into power in Ottawa is going to necessarily change that, although I expect that they will try to tell the voters of Canada that that will take place. Obviously, Mr. Trump wants to focus on China. And to that end, he may try to improve relations with Russia. But that's going to be difficult because Russophobia is so deeply inured in academia, in the political class, to a certain extent in the media, that would be a difficult trick to pull off. But Mr. Trump, he has the majority of the settler vote behind him. And in this settler colonial state, if you have the majority of the settler descendants behind you, you can basically get away literally with murder. And I was mentioning Thomas Frank, who wrote the book, What's the Matter with Kansas? One of the reasons that I raised his name is that in the New York Times, he says that he knew Trump would win when he went to an exhibit in Washington and he saw the phrase settler colonialism in one of the exhibits. He sees that as a no-no term. You're not supposed to use that term because it makes the settlers uncomfortable. Yeah, that's my interpretation of what he's saying. Or that it makes little Johnny and little Jennifer feel badly about living in the settler colonial state. So I guess we're not supposed to say what it really happens. How are people supposed to figure out why 200 years ago Texas was ruled by Comanches and now it's ruled by settlers? I mean, was it an act of God? I mean, did somebody raise wave a magic wand and made the Comanches disappear? And this is a guy on the left who's saying this, supposedly. In any event, back to the major thread. So it's going to be difficult to wage this new Cold War against China. Once again, I could see Mr. Trump exercising his core functions, sending a message to Beijing, which is send my family $100 billion and we'll ease tensions. And that would be presumptively legal under this mafia state known as the United States of America. In any case, if he does try to raise tensions with Beijing, why should Russia go along? The United States has spent decades trying to overthrow first the Soviet Union and now the post-Soviet Union regime. And they're not supposed to believe Mr. Trump when he wants to improve relations. And in any case, the same threats he's making to Canada, he's making to the European Union. That is to say, threats of raising tariffs on their goods. Actually, the not-so-hidden agenda is that Mr. Trump wants to cut taxes against the 1% and make up the shortfall with tariffs so that Social Security and other programs will not end or be eroded. So in other words, he wants to turn the United States into what otherwise would be called the major welfare recipient of planet Earth. And that's to say, he wants Canadian taxpayers, European taxpayers, Chinese taxpayers to pay for the United States of America. Really? I mean, I know it sounds like science fiction, but that seems to be the goal. With regard to Cuba, obviously, he's going to try to turn the screws. He talked previously about sending troops into Mexico. I think that that's going to drive Mexico, 130 million strong, closer to Cuba. He talked previously about seizing Venezuelan oil. I think that you can envision an axis involving Cuba, Venezuela, and Mexico. So this election has been a disaster. We should not try to sugarcoat it. If we do, that means we're hypocritical. In other words, we're telling our comrades and constituents a week ago that fascism was on the ballot. Now we're saying, maybe not. You know, he got less votes this time than he did in 2020. So, you know, relax, calm down, go to sleep. Over.
You're listening to Diasporic Music. Are you still there, Gerald?
Yes, sir. Still there.
I don't know. Had you finished? You hadn't finished your point, had you?
Over. Finished.
Oh, okay. What do you think about the Democratic Party in terms of how is the Democratic Party going to recover from this disaster that took place?
It's a good question. Well, let me make my proposal I'll be making all week. I think that if you look historically at how profound change has happened in the United States, it's oftentimes required extensive external assistance. I've mentioned this many times with regard to the impact of the Haitian Revolution and British and Canadian abolitionism on slavery, the impact of the Cold War and the rise of national liberation movements, the role of the socialist camp in causing Jim Crow to retreat, U.S. apartheid. So my proposal today, and comrades conveyed this to the relevant parties, is that the NAACP, the National Association for the Advancement of Colored People, should call for a conference in Ottawa or Toronto. I say Ottawa so that they can invite embassies of aforementioned nations. Now, of course, NAACP are scaredy cats, so they probably won't carry through on this, but I'll mention it anyway. Embassies of China, Russia, Jamaica, Barbados, South Africa, et cetera. The agenda, stopping the mass deportation of maybe upwards of 500,000 Haitians, not to mention millions of others. And of course, reparations and police terror in the United States of America. I don't expect the NAACP to carry forth with that suggestion. So I would also like to recommend to the African People's Socialist Party and the All African People's Revolutionary Party that they work with our friends and comrades in Cuba on a similar agenda that would also include halting the blockade. In conferences like this, the fact that they're held is as important as anything else. That is to say, getting under one roof, friends and comrades from North America with friends and comrades from Cuba and Venezuela and Mexico and Jamaica and China and Russia, that in itself is a major breakthrough, irrespective of what action and declaration emerges. But certainly we need that kind of game-changing initiative to beat back the fascist attack, because that's what's in store. And I got sort of worked up this morning because I was talking to an intelligent young man about the fact that a leading Trump lawyer, and I'm going to quote him even though it's profane, made threats to the black woman who's attorney general of New York State, who sued Mr. Trump for millions of dollars and won. And that sum is yet to be paid. He's appealing. Letitia James is her name. She might even run for governor. And this Trump lawyer said that if she doesn't back off, excuse me for saying this, but I want to give the, it's all in the newspaper, so I'm not saying anything that hasn't been repeated elsewhere. He says, we're going to put your fat ass in prison. That's what he told her to this Black woman elected official. And this intelligent young Black man that I was talking to this morning, he says, so what? That has nothing to do with me. And I was gobsmacked. I was dumbfounded. I mean, were we that detached from reality? Were we so incapable of connecting the dots that we think that a Black woman attorney general can be threatened and it has nothing to do with you? That the Trump team can threaten to investigate and jail all of its political opponents? Now, I'm talking about people like Nancy Pelosi, the former speaker, the Obamas, the Bidens, the Clintons. I know people don't like them, but it's not as if that has nothing to do with you, because if he can do it to the powerful, he can do it to the less powerful. And it also, it's an emblem of the impending fascism. When you put, when you basically break with bourgeois democracy, so-called, which had a sort of rules of order, where you didn't necessarily try to jail your political opponents on the bourgeois level. So obviously we're moving to a different stage. And if you're not able to see that, as I said, with every passing day, I'm getting more thoroughly disgusted with the United States of America. Over.
Could I cut you off for a second?
Sure.
The All African People's Revolutionary Party, there's a young man by the name of Barry Shango. Barry Shango has been going to, he was born in Jamaica and grew up in Chicago. I met him, I think he was 13, but he was a close comrade of Kwame Ture. He has very good relationships with Cuba and with Venezuela. He's done support work around South America and the Caribbean. Also, members of the African People's Socialist Party, Mwezi Odom, she was in Cuba recently. So I think that the proposal that you are putting forth, hopefully it's already in the mix in terms of people are already talking about that, hopefully.
Mm-hmm. Well, as I said, I think this young brother I was talking to this morning, he even dismissed the idea that there are going to be mass deportations because he says that the immigrants are too important to the economy. Well, yeah, I know they're important to the economy. I also know that there are economists at the University of Chicago who said that the very concept of Jim Crow didn't make any sense because stores were turning away the greenbacks of Black customers. Well, yeah, they were turning away the greenbacks of Black customers, and there was Jim Crow at some point under capitalism. You have to realize that folks are willing and able and capable of absorbing blows to their pocketbook in order to effectuate racist goals, because they think in the long run, the racist goals are essential to their misrule, which in the long run allows them to make up that shortfall that they endured with ousting the immigrants or perpetuating Jim Crow. So, as I said, I think I'm talking to intelligent people. And so when they come to these conclusions, it makes me all the more wary.
What organization does this young brother belong to, or does he belong to an organization?
No, I'm not sure what organization, but he's a teacher. You know, so he's a member of a union. So yeah, that's the organization. I think it's the American Federation of Teachers. But let me return to Trump and foreign policy. So obviously there's going to be more pressure on Iran. The basis has been settled. The basis has been determine. What I mean by that is, just yesterday, Saturday, November 9th, Wall Street Journal had a front page story about the Iranians seeking to assassinate Mr. Trump. So now he has a personal basis for going after the Iranians. Mr. Trump is heavily dependent upon billionaire donations from pro-Zionist forces like Miriam Adelson, who also donates money to Mr. Netanyahu. But see, this brings me to this contradiction. Miriam Adelson, like Elon Musk, a South African-born billionaire, they're all heavily dependent on the Chinese market, as are Apple, Microsoft, KFC, Starbucks in particular. So I'm trying to figure out, how is Trump going to launch a new Cold War against China when many of his donors and supporters are in bed with China? Either A, revert to the previously enunciated principle that they feel in the long run, these billionaires losing money will be made up by overthrowing the Chinese Communist Party, I guess, and then being able to rule China directly, you'll make even more money. I assume that's part of, it's hard for me to think rationally about what is ultimately irrational, which is overthrowing the largest political organization on planet Earth, 90 million strong, the Chinese Communist Party. Or alternatively, once again, this might be some sort of shakedown, where, as you know, in The Art of the Deal, Mr. Trump's book, you issue threats to soften up your negotiating partner. Like, you threaten to put tariffs on Canadian exports, and then they get all upset, and that makes them more amenable to a counterproposal or another proposal. Or, as it happens in New York, you threaten to raise the subway fare 100%, and people get nervous, and that's a negotiating ploy. And then when you raise it only 50%, they'll say, ooh, we got a bargain. So maybe Mr. Trump is making these threats against China to soften them up. So, as noted, if it's constitutional and legal for him to go to China and say, give my family $100 billion and we'll leave you alone, maybe that's the ploy. I mean, excuse that sort of speculation, because I usually try to avoid speculation, try to stick to facts, because the facts are bad enough as they are. But it's something I'm having trouble understanding, how this proposed Cold War II against China. With regard to Latin America, I've already talked about the negative relations we can expect with regard to Cuba, Venezuela, and Mexico. South Africa is in the crosshairs. Both wings of the ruling elite object to South Africa's membership in BRICS, Brazil, Russia, India, China, and South Africa. They don't like the fact that South Africa has dragged Israel, U.S. ally, into an international court of justice and made out a plausible case for genocide. It's no accident that perhaps the final trip of Mr. Biden's reign will take place in a few weeks when he goes to Angola, Southwest Africa, not to pay homage to the victims of the unlimited African slave trade, of which Angola was a major victim, but to try to gain leverage against South Africa and, of course, Zimbabwe as well. The U.S. policy towards Africa is going to cause friction and tension with France, which is rapidly losing its neo-colonial empire with the formation of the Alliance of Sahel States, Mali, Burkina Faso, and Niger. The United States would like to move in as France has moved out. There'll be a lot of competition because even though there's a lot of focus on China and Africa, United Arab Emirates is really playing a major role in Africa, as are the Turks, the major power behind the throne in Somalia, as are, of course, the neocolonial powers, traditionally Britain and France in the first instance. Speaking of Britain and France, Germany is in a shambles right now. Its government is falling apart, which is going to make it very difficult for France, even if it wanted to organize a anti-U.S. imperialist bloc, because its partner, Germany is in shambles with the coalition led by Chancellor Scholz and Social Democrats falling apart. However, France does have the strong left-wing movement to execute an anti-imperialist bloc. But of course, Mr. Macron, even though he has pretensions and ambitions, sometimes France folds like a cheap suit when it comes time to execute, for example, particularly going against the wishes of Uncle Sam. Over.
Your sister, Malaika Horn, has traced, you mentioned Angola, your sister has traced your roots, the Horn family's roots to Angola. Have you and her had any lengthy discussions about that?
No, but I'm happy to say that my latest research project to be launched this month will be on slavery in Mississippi. And one of the basic questions on the agenda is, why has Mississippi been the epicenter of anti-blackness? What is it about Mississippi that pushed it into that role? Was it because the fierce resistance of the indigenous and ousting them from their land, speaking of the Choctaw and the Chickasaw, helped to engender a culture of violence that then was transferred after liquidation of the indigenous to Black people? That is one of the questions I'm going to try to answer as I visit Natchez, Biloxi, Hattiesburg, Jackson, et cetera.
Well, I remember, I'll tell you this, we were sitting, a group of expatriates from the United States. There must have been at five, maybe seven of us sitting there, some from Chicago, some from New York, and all of us had ties to Mississippi, every single one of us. You know, on my father's side, my grandmother, who was a Glover, she was born in Mississippi. There was another brother by the name of Jeribu Kason. He had roots in Mississippi and Arkansas. And Vern Smith, who has got a new book out, he is from Natchez, Mississippi. He's a great historian. You've interviewed him once or twice on mm-hmm. Diasporic Music. Yeah, mm-hmm. That Mississippi thing, I would definitely be looking forward to that. And let me ask you this last question. What, you know, the question of why were so many of us taken to Mississippi?
Well, I can partially explain that. You know, I've just finished my manuscript for my next book, The Capital of Slavery, Washington, D.C., 1800 to 1865. And so what happens is that Virginia was the epicenter of enslaved African population. The problem right. was that Virginia, as you know, is close to Washington, D.C., and the Negroes were always conspiring with those, particularly the British during the War of 1812, who wanted to overthrow the government in Washington, D.C. And so the idea was to ship Black people to Mississippi. At the same time, soil exhaustion was taking place in Virginia because of tobacco, whereas mm-hmm. cotton was booming as agribusiness. So the idea was you ship the Black people from Virginia to Mississippi. In fact, I've come to find out that my ancestors were part of those who were shipped from Virginia to Mississippi, for example.
Mine too.
Yes. So and another aspect that you'll find in my The Capital of Slavery book on Washington is actually deal with Maryland, D.C. and Virginia, the DMV, is that one of the least discussed aspects of slavery in that area as part of the export market of Africans is that these were breeding areas. In other words, they were breeding Africans like you breed racehorses and cows. As a matter of fact, you notice in my Brazil book, I talked about how the Southerners who were ambassadors to Brazil, they objected to the African slave trade from Angola to Brazil not because they were humanitarians, but they wanted Virginia to dominate that market by breeding Africans and shipping them to Virginia, for example.
Right.
And of course, some of the slave owners, as they called themselves, they were self-breeders. In other words, they did not necessarily rely on African men to breed these enslaved. In other words, they'd rape African women to produce commodities. And then that's left DC, Virginia, the lingering issue of colorism. Because historically, you've had a significant number of so-called light-skinned Negroes in that area, which has created a certain amount of social tensions. That's all in my next book. Look for it in about 9 to 10 months. The Capital of Slavery, Washington, D.C., 1800 to 1865.
You've given us a 1 minute extra, so thank you, sir.
Thank you.
And we'll see you, holler at you next week.
Yes, sir. Good luck.
Melinda Francis. Well, first of all, I'd like to thank Lisa Watson for doing a magnificent job of keeping us.
We state these facts only to let you know that those of us who are revolutionary, Pan-Africanists, is not because we love revolution. It is historically determined, and we have no alternative but to follow history and to use history for the benefit of our people.
Power, power, power to the people. Power.